Read some of her classics on the regulation and function of the uncoupling protein. And this research topic is still very much an important part of her current research program. Marie-Hélène got her PhD from the University of Ottawa in 1991. She then went on to do a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Cambridge with Dr. Morgan Brand. Right after that, she got an assistant professorship at the University of Ottawa, where now she's a full professor. She has, as you can imagine, numerous awards and honors, which I cannot list. But let's just mention two recent ones, where she was appointed as a member of the International Association for the Study of Obesity. And she was also recently elected to as a Canadian representative on the North American Obesity Society Council. She trained, you know, many people, sitting on a very important committee related to metabolism. But perhaps, I mean, as you can see, this is very long, and this is the short version. So, but perhaps the best indication of the impact of breadth of her research is that she published more than 100 papers directly related to metabolism and mitochondrial bioenergetics. We're really pleased to have her with us today. And she's going to talk about uncoupling, which is basically variable efficiency of mitochondrial OxPhos and its implications for obesity.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, Julie, for that really nice introduction, and thank you all for coming, and I'm looking forward to telling you about some of our recent research and meeting with more of you this afternoon. It was great to meet a few of you this morning. So what I'm going to try to do in the next 45 or 50 minutes or so is to really focus on the question of variable efficiency and energy capture kind of mechanisms in mitochondria and the role of the uncoupling proteins. And I'm going to try to take it to the clinical perspective. So I'll have some biochemical mechanistic slides in here as well, but I wanted to kind of pull together some of our findings from the clinical populations that we've been studying. So, you know, do these differences in mitochondrial efficiency actually matter in tissue at the whole body level. So this work that I'm going to be talking about represents a collaboration from my clinical colleagues, Ruth McPherson and Bob Dent in Ottawa, who I've been collaborating with for, 14, 15 years now. So that's what I'd like to tell you about largely today. So the focus is going to be on obesity. And, you know, as you know, obesity is a growing concern internationally. It's the point that I really want to make here is that it's a complex metabolic disorder with many potential factors contributing to its development, which ultimately, you know, results when there is an extended period of positive energy balance, where energy in exceeds the amount of energy expended. And we've been very interested in inter-individual susceptibility to obesity and metabolic disorders associated with obesity, like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. And so you can imagine that, you know, in different individuals, altered expression or function of gene sets affecting appetite, overall energy expenditure, adipose tissue biology, and what is most interesting to us, skeletal muscle energetics, may be etiologically significant for that inter-individual variability in susceptibility and success to treatment regimens. So in this regard, you know, our research has focused largely on skeletal muscle bioenergetics. And at the whole body level, skeletal muscle, on average, estimated to account for about 40% of total body weight in adults. And in terms of resting metabolic rate, it's estimated to be responsible for about a fifth, so 20% of resting metabolic rate. So it contributes a very large extent to total body energy expenditure. And the processes that I'm going to be talking about, uncoupling of oxidative phosphorylation in mitochondria, and inefficiency in energy capture, it's been estimated that about half of resting energy expenditure in muscle is due to these leak mechanisms, because ATP demand at rest is minimal. So about half of that 20% of resting metabolic rate in skeletal muscle is due to these leak mechanisms. So we're very interested in these leak mechanisms in skeletal muscle. So let's just look at the mechanisms that we're talking about here. So this is, you know, your metabolic biochemistry, OxPhos. So you know these concepts of the coupling of energy expenditure, the breakdown of fatty acids, provision of reducing equivalents that funnel into the electron transport chain, and then that gives the electron transport chain the power to pump protons out of the matrix into the intermembrane space to produce this proton motive force. And then that proton motive force drives the molecular motor ATP synthase to produce ATP. Then the ATP is exported out into the cell to support work or to be stored as adipose triacylglycerol if there's an excess of energy. So this is coupled ATP synthesis. In the uncoupled state, which is quite significant in resting tissues when ATP demand is not high, this occurs when protons somehow leak back into the mitochondrial matrix and through any mechanism bypassing ATP synthase. So you're not capturing all that energy that is burned through catabolic mechanisms. The energy is simply wasted as heat. You don't get ATP, so the energy is wasted. Now, this has implications, obviously, for efficiency of energy capture, how much energy is available for triglyceride synthesis, for example, but it also has great significance for the amount of reactive oxygen species that are emitted from mitochondria. And this is an area that Dr. St-Pierre has focused on over the years and published important papers on the sites of reactive oxygen species production along the electron transport chain. But when proton motive force is high, protons are not returning to the matrix either through ATP synthase or through an uncoupling leak kind of mechanism here. Proton motive force is high. Reducing equivalents or electrons can escape off the electron transport chain, interact with oxygen there, producing superoxide and other reactive oxygen species. So, as I'll come to later, a leak bringing down proton motive force keeps electrons in the electron transport chain. They keep moving along instead of leaking off and interacting with oxygen. So there are implications for these uncoupling processes for reactive oxygen species production and therefore implications for oxidative stress and oxidative damage, and also for ROS signaling in cells. Okay, so let's now look at the proteins that are related to these uncoupling processes, the proton leak processes in the mitochondrial inner membrane. The best known uncoupling protein really is the uncoupling protein 1, exclusively expressed in brown adipocytes, in brown fat. And there, through experiments in USP1 knockout mice and other studies, it's quite clear that its physiological function is uncoupling for the purposes of thermoregulation. So if you knock out USP1, put a mouse in the cold, it will die because of the necessity of that uncoupling there to produce heat for thermoregulation. Now, in the late 1990s, the novel uncoupling proteins, as they're still referred to, were identified, and they're expressed in other tissues, and their functions have been quite controversial, not well understood. UCP2 has a pretty broad tissue distribution. UCP3 expressed in skeletal muscle, brown adipose tissue, and in diabetic heart. And the other uncoupling proteins, USP4, USP5, largely in the central nervous system, some in the liver. And the understanding of these uncoupling proteins is really very rudimentary at this point because so much attention has been focused on USP2, USP3 to try to figure out exactly what they're doing. And in the hundreds of papers in the literature, there seems to be some consistent observation that these uncoupling proteins really do have a role in keeping ROS levels down. They don't seem to be there for thermoregulatory purposes at all, but play a role somehow in ROS and maybe ROS signaling in this diverse array of cell types in which they're expressed. And in the literature, you know, these novel uncoupling proteins, USP2 to 5, have been associated with things like hunger and satiety in hypothalamic cells, protection against neurodegeneration, protection from ischemic injury, protection against obesity and insulin resistance, which I'll focus on largely here today, insulin and glucagon release in the pancreas, and resistance in tumor cells to cytotoxic therapies. And I'll point to a couple of observations about that a little bit later. But I really want to focus on skeletal muscle. And again, in skeletal muscle, there's just one uncoupling protein at the protein level, USP3. And the original hypothesis around USP3 and USP2 was that it causes a mild uncoupling triggered by reactive oxygen species to keep reactive oxygen species down. And this was a paper published out of Martin Brand's laboratory, and Julie St-Pierre contributed to this publication as well in Nature back in 2002. So, and this original hypothesis really has held true to the fact that this uncoupling protein functions in a negative feedback loop to keep ROS emission from the electron transport chain at low levels. But there are metabolic implications of the activity of UCP3 in skeletal muscle as well. And in these studies out of my group, these studies have been conducted in mouse models, UCP3 knockout mice, UCP3 overexpression mice, and we have found that UCP3 is essential for normal, healthy fatty acid metabolism, but you can't see that if you do studies in isolated mitochondria. It has to be in the intact cell or tissue level. and protection from obesity and insulin resistance. Again, studies in knockout mice and transgenic mice being protected. So altogether, the results support the idea that USP3 is activated by reactive oxygen species somehow. We'll come back to that a little bit later. And by activating it, membrane potential comes down, and ROS emission from the electron transport chain goes down. But this costs energy because a proton leak is involved and energy is not captured as ATP. It's released as heat. Small amounts, but it can be quite significant. So at this point, I just wanted to identify some of the recent studies we've been doing in the last few years to try to figure out how uncoupling protein 2 and 3 are triggered by reactive oxygen species. And so these are mechanistic studies that we've been doing, kind of prompted by a discussion I had with David Nichols at a meeting a few years ago. And he said, it seems like it might have something to do with glutathione. And I thought, well, okay, I don't really know too much about the interaction of glutathione and the uncoupling proteins. And then I met someone else, you know how these things go, someone else at the conference said, what do you know about glutathione, glutathionation of proteins? And that's where all of this began. So you may know that glutathionation is a form of post-translational modification of proteins. And back in 2011, a very talented postdoc in my group, Ryan Mayu, who's been leading all of this in my lab, showed that the deglutathionation, the removal of glutathione from key cysteine residues in USP2 and 3, causes an activation of the leak uncoupling. And we've followed up with some other studies showing that this matters in the sense that it affects USP2 function in pancreatic beta cells, where it plays a role in insulin-stimulated or glucose-stimulated insulin secretion. And so that was a collaboration with Rob Screeton and Michael Wheeler. And then more recently, we've kind of gone back to the story around drug-resistant tumor cells, which you all know much more about than I do, but we picked up on some of earlier studies that we had done in drug-resistant tumor cells or cytotoxic-resistant tumor cells. And we found that if you inhibit the uncoupling protein 2 in these tumor cells, you increase ROS production, making those tumor cells more susceptible to cytotoxic therapies, chemotherapeutic reagents. So that's a recent paper that we have published in regard to glutathionation control of UCP2 and 3. And our most recent observations kind of looked at, how this glutathionation occurs. Is it something like a stochastic type of mechanism that the glutathione levels, oxidized glutathione levels increase, and thus glutathione interacts with those cysteine residues, or is it an enzymatic kind of mediated process? And the glutaredoxin that is found specifically in the mitochondrial matrix, at least in skeletal muscle, but interestingly not in brown fat, we have found that this protein is the one that deglutathionates and activates uncoupling protein 3. So we've been doing some studies in GRIX2 knockout mice and have found that this protein is important in the activation of the uncoupling proteins. So I'm not going to go into detail here, but it appears, again, that glutaredoxin 2, mitochondrial matrix enzyme, deglutathionates and activates the uncoupling proteins. And the key cysteine residue that we think is most important because of its position there, it's in the last matrix loop of uncoupling protein 3. And if you mutate it, then you no longer can modulate the protein's activity through glutathionation. It's the cysteine residue 259. The 25 cysteine residue is also important, but it's in a transmembrane domain. We don't really know what that means. It may indeed also be functionally important, but a lot more work has to be done. So uncoupling proteins 2 and 3 should be considered as in a growing list of mitochondrial proteins that are controlled by ROS, redox, glutathionation of these important mitochondrial proteins. And this is just a slide in which I've tried to summarize a potential mechanism through which glutaredoxin 2 deglutathionates and activates the uncoupling protein. So we think the trigger, or we've shown that the trigger is very low levels of reactive oxygen species that trigger ROS redox mechanisms within the matrix, we think, that cause the deglutathionation and activation of glutaredoxin 2 that then deglutathionates UCP2 or UCP3 to activate the uncoupling protein. Okay, so now I'd like to kind of step back again and kind of look at these inefficiencies in mitochondrial energetics and how this relates to susceptibility to obesity and success in hypocaloric dietary therapies. And so, again, this is a collaboration that goes back 14, 15 years with Bob Dent and Ruth McPherson. Bob is the director of the Obesity Management Program at the Ottawa Hospital, and Ruth is the director of the Lipids Clinic and does a lot of GWAS and genomic studies at the Ottawa Heart Institute. And we've been working on this for quite some time. And the initial observation was that individuals who otherwise should respond similarly to a hypocaloric regimen in the hospital have hugely different rates of weight loss, especially in the when you look at the first 6 weeks of the program where individuals are highly compliant, and these are individuals who are not taking any medications that affect weight gain or weight loss, and there's a huge inter-individual variability. So we hypothesized, as you might imagine, that we wanted to look at efficiency of oxidative phosphorylation in skeletal muscle because of its energetic importance. And so this weight loss clinic protocol is intensively supervised by Bob Dent, and he's got thousands of patient records, and there are a large number of weekly visits and so forth. So in the first 12 weeks of the program, individuals are on this quite severe hypocaloric diet, 900 kilocalories per day. Compliance is monitored by records from the clinician, the physician records, returned packets of this Optifast diet made by Nestle now, precise composition, all of their attendance at the weekly sessions and their blood work and so forth. You know, we don't lock them up to assess adherence or compliance, but we do throw out about half to two-thirds of the potential patients for any questions about dietary adherence. So we're really looking at comparisons between fast and slow losers who are identified as being highly diet compliant. And here are some of the weight trajectories for 1,800 diet adherent subjects. We evaluate weight loss on the basis of three repeat measures prior to and at the end of the first 6 weeks of the program to define them as being diet sensitive or fast losers or diet resistant or slow losers. And here's a graph of, an example of the differences in the rate of weight loss in these individuals who are matched for initial body weight, age, gender, and are highly diet adherent. And so we make all of our comparisons in skeletal muscle and so forth between these two groups. And ODS versus ODR is defined as the rate of weight loss in the first 6 weeks. And here you can see the trajectories for weight loss over a longer period of time. and then, for example, at a muscle biopsy. So once we have identified the ODS and ODR individuals, we have been conducting muscle biopsies in individuals once they've completed the program and are in a weight-stable state. And we use the muscle for gene expression profiling, immunohistochemistry of muscle, mitochondrial isolations. More recently, we've been using the permeabilized myofiber technique to look at mitochondria in situ in myofibers and using an Ouroboros high-resolution respirometer. And we isolate the satellite cells and differentiate them into tubes and compare energetics in these cells in culture. And this slide just summarizes the overall findings over the years. First, we observed this clinical phenotype of fast losers versus slow losers or diet-sensitive versus diet-resistant. And then back in 2002, we published this first paper showing that mitochondrial proton leak or energy kind of wastage mechanisms in the mitochondria were 50% higher in the muscle mitochondria from the fast losers or diet-sensitive individuals than the slow losers. And that's shown here. So this is the kind of resting metabolic rate kind of determined maximum proton leak energy wastage, oxygen consumption shown here for the diet-resistant individuals, and it was found to be 50% higher in the mitochondria from the diet-resistant individuals. So that was back in 2002 that we published that, and since then we've been looking at gene expression profiling in skeletal muscle and in whole blood, and shown that gene expression profiling is dramatically different between these two patient populations. Then we thought that we would move into studies of mitochondria within cells. And so we thought, well, we'll take the satellite cells, differentiate them in culture, study them, and we'll look at mitochondria in situ and see if this proton leak is still higher in the myotubes in culture. But we thought, well, first we should really determine if there are any differences in composition of the muscle that we're biopsying. Are there differences in muscle fiber composition, muscle fiber size, lipid content, mitochondrial content, and so forth? And to our surprise, there were great differences in fiber type. The diet-sensitive individuals have much more oxidative fibers in their vastus lateralis, which is the largest and easiest quadricep muscle to biopsy. And you can see here the type 1 fibers. And here we have the diet-sensitive, diet-resistant, and a lean control group. And there are also interesting differences in type 2A and type 2X, the highly glycolytic fibers here that we should follow up with as well. Fibers were also larger in the diet-sensitive individuals than the diet-resistant individuals.
And then can I ask you, so yeah. Was that true all the way through the study? And even the first time you took the biopsy, were they different already, or this was acquired?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So when... But so this was done after they've completed the program. They're in a weight-stable state. So, you know, to identify fast losers, slow losers, so we can't biopsy them at the beginning because we really don't know who's going to be a fast loser and slow loser. So we can't do a before and after. We'd have to biopsy a very large number of individuals to answer that question. But the literature says that weight loss in humans doesn't affect fiber proportions. But we have some results from mice. I want to show you a little bit later that may not be that. Well, mice and humans are different, but it's something that we hope to study later in bariatric surgery patients before and after bariatric surgery and weight loss. So it's a good question, yeah. And let's see. And we've also recently conducted some GWAS studies to look at genes that are associated with rate of weight loss. And there are seven promising loci, one of which is PDSS1, responsible for the synthesis of coenzyme, elongation of coenzyme Q that we're trying to follow up in vitro studies. So you have very clear evidence that muscle gene expression between these two patient populations is very different. And, you know, the OXPHOS genes often come out very high, even in some of our studies in which we looked at circulating transcripts. OXPHOS genes come out high, and they're published in another paper by Sujoy Ghosh et al. And replicated some of these as well. So there are a lot of very interesting mitochondrial transcripts that should be followed up on as well, like this isocitrate dehydrogenase, you know, the supposed rate-limiting step of the TCA cycle being dramatically different between these two patient populations, something that we haven't followed up on yet. So once we eventually completed that study looking at differences in fiber composition and so forth in the muscle, we got to the study of looking at energetics and differentiated myotubes in culture. And there's an image of some differentiated tubes on the left-hand side here. And this work was conducted in a blinded fashion by a new master student at the time in my lab, Rennie Zong, who's here at McGill doing her PhD now. And we looked at leak-dependent respiration, this state 4 respiration, in low glucose and high glucose conditions. And just to determine whether or not there might be differences in one and not the other. But in both kind of conditions, we saw that in the myotubes from the diet-resistant individuals, leak-dependent respiration was about half of that than the myotubes from the diet-sensitive individuals. So this is still unpublished. We're conducting complementary analyses around reactive oxygen species handling in these tubes, and are hoping to complete that soon. Okay, so I'm going to turn a page now to a mouse model. So surprisingly, over the years, we tried to publish that work, and there were, as I was saying to Dr. Sanfier this morning, you know, a lot of concerns initially about adherence. Are you studying cheaters and non-cheaters in the program? Are the slow losers, because they're just not adhering to the diet? And people also said, you really need a mouse model. So you could publish this work in a higher impact journal if you had a good mouse model. And we've got, you know, this UCP3 transgenic mouse, and they're protected from obesity, but obviously it's not just that. So I was at an ADA conference at about that time and heard some of the results from Mary Elizabeth Patty's lab, and she's at the Joslin at Harvard. And she has studied a mouse model in which, an epigenetic type of model, in which you food restrict the pregnant dams, mice, 50% in the last trimester of pregnancy. The pups are born small, but quickly catch up in growth and have a higher level of adiposity and susceptibility to type 2 diabetes and lipoprotein disorders. But the thing that caught my attention there was that they said that they had found that these mice had a lower proportion of oxidative fibers in their muscles. And I thought, well, maybe we should perhaps study this model as a related model to our human studies of diet resistance. So this is the experimental design that we've been following to a T, replicating, you know, exactly what they do. The same strain of mice, these ICR mice, which are like CD1 mice. They're good dams. They foster and take care of their pups very well. And so we did the 50% food restriction in the last 7 days of the pregnancy in the mice, took them out to 10 weeks of age, Sean Chow. And then at 10 weeks of age, we did a food restriction, calorie restriction diet to look at rates of weight loss in the different groups. So in all the next slides, the results from the pups of the undernourished dams are in red, and the results from the control mice are in blue. And we found, like others have found before, but not after food restriction or calorie restriction, that the mice were had a greater proportion of body weight as adipose, higher adiposity. And even after the 4 weeks of 40% calorie restriction, the adiposity was higher in the mice from the undernourished dams. And then if you look at the kind of rate of weight loss during the 40% calorie restriction, you see that the rate of weight loss is slower and the absolute value is lower in the pups from the undernourished dams. And if you compare that in the same express as we kind of express the rate of weight loss in our human populations, you can kind of see the similarities in differences in rate of weight loss and absolute amount of weight lost. So then we went on to look at muscle bioenergetics. So we isolated mitochondria from the muscles, hind limb muscles of these mice. And, of course, we are most interested to look at leak-dependent respiration through uncoupling of whatever mechanism. And if you just focus on the top right here, this state 4 maximal kind of leak-dependent respiration, you see the leak-dependent respiration is much lower in the mitochondria from the pups that came from the undernourished dams. Then we went on to look at potential differences in fiber phenotype, you know, the original observation that Mary Elizabeth Patty talked about at the ADA meeting. And so we looked at proportions of type 1, 2A, the highly glycolytic 2X, and type 2 fibers. And you can see that in the pups from the undernourished dams, and this was all after the calorie restriction at 14 weeks. So we don't, we're currently, this week we're doing the analyses on the proportions of fibers at 10 weeks, so we don't really know if fiber phenotype or typing changes over the calorie restriction protocol, but it seems that it might just be occurring. And mitochondrial content after calorie restriction is lower in the muscle from the calorie restricted animals. Okay, so I was hoping now to just kind of switch to another area related to uncoupling and uncoupling that occurs in brown adipocytes that are associated with skeletal muscle. And this is a collaboration that we recently conducted with Michael Rudnicki, who is a muscle stem cell expert who works at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. And we've collaborated with him on and off over the years about uncoupling in skeletal muscle. And in this paper, we were focusing on the appearance or lineage determination of satellite cells that can be pushed down the brown fat cell lineage. And so it's been known that you will find brown adipocytes and pockets of brown fat in the hind limb muscles of various strains of mice. But the origins of those brown fat cells around skeletal muscle has been very poorly understood. And clearly, the amount of energy that can be wasted through uncoupling in brown fat is much, much higher than that is wasted through a little bit of uncoupling through USP3 or other mechanisms in other tissues. Uncoupling protein 1 uncouples oxidative phosphorylation at very high rates and is therefore responsible for thermogenesis. So brown adipocytes are rich with mitochondria. They're packed with mitochondria, and they're necessary for thermoregulation. So work by Rudnicki and Patrick Seal, who did his PhD in Michael's laboratory and then postdoced with Bruce Spiegelman at Harvard, Patrick Seale's work clearly showed that there are common origins between skeletal muscle cells and brown adipocytes. And he has shown in a number of reports that the expression of this zinc finger transcription factor called PRDM16 is expressed highly in brown adipocytes. And if you force its expression in white adipose tissue pre-adipocytes, you can cause the beiging or the brown fat-like development and the appearance of USP1 and uncoupling in that white adipose tissue converted towards brown, and also in myoblasts. So if you force the expression of PRDM in C2, C12 cells, you will get them to kind of convert into thermogenic brown adipocytes. So for that reason, PRDM16 is referred to as a master regulator of brown adipocyte lineage determination. And so this work that I want to tell you about, led by a postdoc in Michael's laboratory, Hong Yin, was looking at the array of microarrays, microRNAs that interfere with PRDM transcription. And he identified microRNA 133 as an inhibitor of PRDM 16 expression. So the question that we really wanted to pursue in this series of analyses was, if we use an antagomer or antisense oligonucleotide for this microRNA, can we increase PRDM 16 levels and thereby push muscle satellite cells in vivo to brown adipocytes? And would that have a thermogenic or metabolic effect in mice and other systems? So I'm just going to show you the metabolic data. Hong and other people on this publication have beautiful cell tracing lineage data that are shown in this manuscript just recently published in Cell Metabolism. But I just want to show you the metabolic results. So if you just look to the left of this slide here, half of the mice were fed a high-fat diet, the rest just a chow diet. Half of those groups were treated with an antisense oligonucleotide, ASO, for microRNA 133. And that was at this time point here. And because to get satellite cells to be activated, you have to either have, we know that satellite cells are activated through resistance training or some injury to muscle. To get them activated, cardiotoxin was injected into the muscle along with the injection of the ASO for 133. And then over 4 months, we traced food intake, body weight gain, adiposity, metabolic phenotype. And you can see, I don't know if you can read the key here, but whether the mice were fed a high-fat diet or a regular diet, the ASO treatment kept body weight lower in each case. You can see images of the mice over here as well, regular diet and high-fat fed animals. And this was not due to a significant increase in food intake in the mice. So then we went on to assess metabolic characteristics and kind of thermogenesis, energy wastage through potentially increased amounts of brown fat cells in the muscles of these mice. And so we devised a protocol in which we took out the muscle and studied it in the Ouroboros high-resolution respirometer without permeabilizing the muscle so that we could activate USP1 there with fatty acids. Brown fat cells are really unusual in the sense you give them a little bit of fatty acid and there's an immediate uptake of the fatty acid to the mitochondria, activating thermogenesis. So in the non-permeabilized muscle, we added in fatty acid, and we saw an immediate increase in uncoupled respiration in the muscle from the tibialis anterior, where the injection was given 4 months previous. And then we permeabilized the cells and then saw no longer any difference in once we had activated fatty acid oxidation traditionally in the muscle cells there. But then we wanted to look at the whole body in vivo level. So we did some positron emission tomography of glucose uptake into the muscles. And you know, when mitochondria are uncoupled, cells have to rely on glycolysis for ATP production. So if you activate brown fat cells, glucose uptake goes up dramatically because you need the glucose to support glycolysis. And so we looked at that at basal levels, and then we also injected the mice with a bolus dose of a beta-3 adrenergic agonist, which activates brown fat thermogenesis. And so the results are shown here. If we just look in the middle here, this is the hind limb of the ASO-treated animal. So 4 months later, we see a dramatically increased amount of glucose uptake into that area of the hind limb compared to the contralateral, non-injected hind limb of the mice. So very significant increases in glucose uptake associated with that. And in other work, you know, immunohistochemistry, we show the appearance of the brown fat cells within these muscle areas. Not a lot, but the appearance of an increased amount of brown adipose tissue there. And this slide simply quantitates those differences. So baseline in the treated tibialis anterior ASO, no difference in glucose uptake or uncoupling of the muscle there, or the muscle region that would include some of the brown fat cells. And then when we inject just a simple IP injection of this beta-3 adrenergic agonist, you see a very significant increase in glucose uptake into that muscle region through the selective activation of beta-3 adrenergic receptors. And just, you know, as a positive control, you can see that brown fat is, so we looked at the interscapular region for the positron emission tomography in this case, and with the injection of the beta-3 adrenergic agonists, you can see that there was, in both animal groups, very significant increases in glucose uptake, uncoupling of the brown fat because of the beta-3 stimulation. Okay, so I'm going to wrap things up here, and hopefully there's, you know, time for questions about any of this or more. So overall, you know, our findings in the clinical populations have altogether led us to conclude that you know, differences in the composition and metabolism of muscle from diet-sensitive and diet-resistant obese women contribute to some extent to variability in weight loss. And the mechanisms underlying these proton leak differences require a lot more investigation. We have a fairly intensive study going on right now with the hypothesis that reactive oxygen species are handled differently in the muscle of these two groups, and the way that we're trying to tease that apart is by feeding the individuals a high-fat meal after the first biopsy, then doing the second biopsy 6 hours later, where we know from the literature that ROS production is significantly higher. So then we're doing the bioenergetic analyses before and after a high-fat meal. So we think really that these differences are elicited by differences in reactive oxygen species handling by mitochondria. And our studies in mice that I described here today show that in utero food restriction results in offspring with a protective kind of mechanism for species survival overall in times when nutrient supply is restricted. And specifically, we've found that calorie restriction in these mice at 10 weeks of age results in decreases in the rate of weight loss, increased adiposity, decreased skeletal muscle mitochondrial content, decreased proton leak-dependent respiration as studied in isolated mitochondria, and now we're doing some work in permeabilized myofibers, and decreases in the proportions of the oxidative, highly metabolic muscle fibers. And lastly, I described some of our recent findings in which we worked with Michael Rudnicki to elicit the development of brown fat-induced thermogenesis or energy wastage in traditional skeletal muscle kind of depots in the body. And my most important slide here is all the people I have to thank, the various members in the laboratory who have really done so much work in this regard. Brittany Beauchamp led the work on the epigenetic model of weight loss resistance, and she spent 3 months in Mary Elizabeth Patty's lab this last fall. Ryan Mayhew has led the charge for all the glutathionation work, and hopefully glutathionation will be something that he will develop further as an independent investigator soon, and various other members of the laboratory as well. My clinical collaborators, Ruth and Bob, this work that I've talked about here today, and many of our collaborators as well. So thank you very much again, and I'll be happy to answer questions. Yeah, that's a very important question. Yeah. So in our earlier studies, we had information from surveys on activity at work and daily activities. So we quantitated that, but we didn't have accelerometer data. We're doing that for this study now. But those data suggested that there were not significant differences. And during the first 6 weeks of the program, you know, it's such a drastic, for most people, decrease in energy intake, they're advised not to be physically active. And most of these individuals are not physically active at that point. Yeah. Well, you know, the literature... you have to exercise quite a lot to make differences in proportions, especially between type 1 and type 2 fibers. The effect of weight loss, so all of this is done after they've lost the weight and they're a weight-stable situation. The literature suggests that weight loss should not result in the differences that we observe, but we don't know for sure. So in a study that we've just... begun. We're hoping to take muscle biopsies before bariatric surgery and after 1 year after bariatric surgery. So again, you know, they'll be losing a lot of weight there for a different reason. But we're only studying individuals who have completed previously the behavioral program and have been identified as being a fast loser or a slow loser. It was a surprise to see that, yeah.
Okay. So, this is Sarah again, Marilyn. I have a question about the, is there any correlate between the fast losers having problems with ghrelin or leptin so that they would have normally been gaining a lot of weight because of eating habits, whereas the slow losers is really a metabolic problem.
Yeah.
It wasn't because they were necessarily...
Yeah, yeah. That's really important. We kind of touched on that this morning when we were talking about it because we don't know. But we would suspect that there probably is something like that. We're looking at the extremes. So the upper quintile for rate of weight loss and the lowest quintile for rate of weight loss. And there probably is something there. You know, we try to think, okay, which of the two populations is more like of a normal? Are the fast losers the unusual ones or the slow loser ones the unusual ones? And we really don't know. But, you know, when we... meet the patients and talk with them, sometimes it seems, you know, like that individuals who are the fast losers perhaps have more of a drive to eat. And so once the intake is restricted, then they can drop the weight very quickly. Whereas, as you say, you know, the slow losers, they're resistant because of metabolic mechanisms. That, yeah. Yeah.
Just a quick question on the microRNA. So you didn't show that, but I assume that the PRDM16 change in the muscles from the injections of the NT. So is that has been done?
Yeah. A lot that
the other thing which
should
is
have said.
Interesting to me is that the model, the mouse model that you're using is a non-inbred strain.
For the epigenetic model or the food restriction?
And that was my next follow-up on that. So have you looked at epigenetic changes in these key mitochondrial enzymes which are controlling?
No.
So this
has no, we haven't.
Because that would be also extremely interesting.
Yeah. So the reason why we work with the ICR strain, first of all, we wanted to do exactly what they did in their laboratory, strain everything just the same. You can also use CD1. They're also very good. They're kind of low-stress type of animals. If you can do the same thing with C57 black mice as well, but for some of those more nervous strains of mice, the food restriction in the last trimester, it's just so much of a stressor that not many of the pups survive. The dams don't suckle or take care of the pups, and you don't have as many pups surviving. So compared to the control litters, we get maybe 30% less pups kind of surviving. It's quite a significant metabolic insult.
To follow on that, is that the reason why you didn't do it with the transgenic PCP?
Yeah.
Because I thought that would be very important for the question of the proton leak.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's more risky.
Yeah, if you don't get nitrogen.
Yeah.
It's pretty risky.
Yeah. Yeah, it can get pretty expensive. So it's a really interesting area. So there's this U-shaped curve, and it's called the Barker hypothesis of epigenetics. And so it's the risk for having healthy pups susceptible to metabolic diseases is a U-shaped curve. So if there isn't enough fed during pregnancy, risk is high. Then normal, risk is low. And if you overfeed and there's obesity and so forth during pregnancy, then the risk goes back up again. We chose this model, again, because there seemed to be something really interesting in the skeletal muscle that we wanted to pursue. But what might be obviously more relevant in our society these days would be to study obese mice and their pups. But we haven't done that.
One last question. So you start your talk by saying that there's epidemic obesity. This is true. Yeah. However, for the past 3 years in the United States and Canada, it's really plateauing.
Yeah.
And we see this very well. In fact, in some places, even going down in Mississippi, which is one of the highest places.
Yeah.
So is it because people are better behaved, or there's a certain percentage of populations that can get fat and the other one do not?
It's probably both, but I think that the genetic susceptibility is really more on an individualized kind of level. That
because your test on the report is exactly this. I mean, if you could predict by a muscle biopsy that which part you count, it would be. But it's interesting because people still think it's going up. It's not. I think there's a new plateau everywhere, and this is going to be very much resolved. I think that in one way or the other.
Yes. Yeah. And I love this quote from the former director of the diabetes, the Institute of Nutrition, Metabolism, Diabetes at CIHR, Diane Feingood, used to say, you know, obesity is not rocket science. And then she'd pause and people, and she'd say, it's more complex. I mean, it's so complex that, you know, it seems simple. It's simple imbalance, energy in, energy out. That's simple. But individual susceptibility and then, how you solve societal behavior and so forth is more, it's very complex. But, yeah.
I want to ask one last question. So you mentioned in your talk that the RAS are important to activate the uncoupling protein, and the uncoupling protein are very important to determine standard metabolic rate, right?
Yeah.
So can you comment on if you eat different types of food? How does it affect RAS production and the UCP? Like, is it different if you eat carbohydrate versus lipid?
Well, RAS emission from mitochondria seems to go up quite a lot with fatty acid oxidation.
So you get more RAS production.
Get more RAS production. Yeah.
Okay. And then you would activate, in theory, more the UCP.
If you're capable of doing that,
okay.
Right? So that's what we're trying to get at with this high-fat milkshake that we're giving individuals after an initial biopsy. Because Daryl Neufer and his colleagues showed that this same sort of high-fat milkshake causes really quite significant increases in muscle reactive oxygen species emissions. So that was Anderson et al., JCI, 2009. And so it may,
Talking about fatty food, we've got to go for pizza.
Yeah.
So you can meet us in the atrium. And thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, great.
The new data that went in was the LCMS data.
I wish I knew that the answer to that. I'd have to look it up. But
I know.
And there's so much interest in brown fat in adult humans right now with the discovery a few years ago of brown fat actually existing in adults. It varies a lot from person to person, so maybe there is. But they refer to it as, the master regulator. But I don't know the PRDM literature to that level. But what we are trying to pursue is, these enteigomers, do they work in human satellite cells? And enteigomer therapy is, in clinical trials, and so does it work on human cells? Well, the focus in this paper was doing cell lineage tracing. So they used this Creed-Lox, TD tomato, kind of fluorescent labeling of the satellite cells, and then they traced them. And so they definitively showed that they were, that they did come from these satellite cells. But if you look at the paper, like, there's not a large number, really, of brown fat cells. They're there,
but
they can make a big difference. But yeah, but I was just flabbergasted just when I saw. I didn't show the indirect calorimetry data, but like 4 months later, a single injection into the TA muscle. 4 months later, and they're saying, "Well, we think we should do indirect calorimetry." So, okay, let's go for it. But the experimental error around indirect calorimetry is 7% or so, and in our human populations, when we try to look for differences between fast losers and slow losers, we're trying to do that better now. But, we're never able to detect that. But there we saw huge differences, a single injection. Thanks.
I think we should move there because people wait for you to eat.
Yes.
All the questions. Yeah. This format, it's not like the speaker comes and there's a pizza.
Is this yours, Julie? Or is it?
Is.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Newgard and Deb Muyo. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that something? I mean, because I'm wondering, are there sort of predictive acylcarnitines or amine levels, without having to do a muscle biopsy?
Yeah.
I mean, because you guys have, way